From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. For the past several decades, New England fishermen have faced increasingly tight regulations on how many days they can go out to sea and how many fish they can bring back. The rules are aimed at allowing fish stocks time to reproduce and replenish themselves so they aren't wiped out completely. Still, there is a lot of debate over how many fish there really are in the sea and to what extent North Atlantic fishermen are overfishing. It's an argument that our guest today says goes back to our nation's earliest days. We're talking with Jeffrey Bolster, a UNH professor and author of the new book, The Mortal Sea. In it, Bolster describes a constant cycle where each new improvement in fishing methods would raise concerns about overfishing. Then, as that new method was more widely adopted, more fish would be pulled from the sea. A cycle that Bolster says has been repeated for so long now that the North Atlantic is simply exhausted, depleted, and may not recover. Today in The Exchange, Jeffrey Bolster on The Mortal Sea. Let's hear from you. If you fish commercially or for sport, what's your sense of how healthy fish stocks are in our region? What's a balanced approach between protecting fisheries and still allowing people to fish? And if the answer is a lot less fish should be brought in, what does that mean for feeding the world's growing populations? The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Post a comment on our Facebook page or on the Exchange page at nhpr.org. You can also send us an email at exchange@nhpr.org. And Jeffrey Bolster, it's nice to meet you. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks, Laura. Nice to be here.
Well, you researched 500 years of fishing records for this book. You know, old journals, scraps of paper, diaries, other documents. What do those earliest records, Jeffrey, say about what the seas were like here when the Europeans first came over, just as fishermen, before they started really settling here?
There was extraordinary abundance. The shoals of silvery mackerel could be seen on the surface stretching for miles. The whales and seals, the oyster beds, everything was not to scale as Europeans imagined it. And the telling point about that is that this North Atlantic ecosystem here from Cape Cod to Newfoundland is basically consists of the same species as the one back in Europe. So it wasn't like going to the Philippines or the Caribbean where everything was new. When Europeans came here, there was herring and salmon and shad and all sorts of fish that were familiar at home. And yet the numbers were extraordinary. So that's what got their attention, whether it was gray seals or harbor seals or cod or whatever. Similar stuff to the things they knew at home, but the abundances were just off the map.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking almost to read those accounts, you know, porpoises leaping out, walruses, I mean, just everything.
Yeah, and, you know, many people since then have said, oh, that was all propaganda. It was just people trying to come to the New World and, you know, enhance promotion of this area. But the more that scientists understand changes in the sea through time, whether they've looked globally at the Adriatic or in places in North Europe or the Americas, it's pretty obvious that the best and the brightest of that generation who are arriving in America, you know, the people that came were often pretty bold and they had a photographer's eye in a pre-photography age and they were journalists and writers. And they were describing things that got their attention. And one of the points I make in the book is that many of these men, of course, were trained mariners. They had been raised on the coast of Europe. Mariners have to be attentive to their surroundings. To not be attentive to their surroundings means death or disaster. So they were recording what they saw. And I don't believe that most of those accounts were promotion. They were written by laity and clergy. They were written by mariners and non-mariners. They were written in French and in English. And there's 150 years of them, and they keep repeating each other. So I don't think it was made up.
Well, you mentioned, you know, some people say, oh, was it propaganda just to get people to come to the New World and invest in these companies and so forth? There's also, though, a sort of almost an emotional or spiritual component to this, that the sea seemed all-powerful, seemed limitless. You know, people had this idea that the sea would never die.
Yeah, and that, I think, has been a sort of a stock notion that really persisted until probably our lifetimes. And much of the weight of literature and science and myth had it that the sea was separate from the land and it was this eternal thing. I mean, someone as perceptive as Rachel Carson wrote in 1951 that man's reach stops with the shore. Well, not so. And I think were Carson alive today, she would want to know why she had called it wrong then. Now, actually, about 10 years later, towards the end of her life, she did retract part of that statement, and she reassessed that, yes, indeed, there were problems with the seat. But my point is that as late as the 1950s, someone as perceptive as Rachel Carson could still imagine that the sea was beyond human impact, even though measurable impacts have been going on for a long time. That's how pervasive the notion was of the eternal sea.
Yeah, it seems amazing to us today because we've been talking about this for a couple of decades now. So that's where the title comes from, Jeffrey, the mortal sea. You're reminding us, no, it's not endless, immortal.
Not immortality, no. Very finite.
Well, I want to invite our listeners to join us and then get into the big themes in this book. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Today in The Exchange, Jeffrey Bolster is here, an assistant history professor at UNH, whose focus is on the history of people's interactions with the sea. And his new book is called The Mortal Sea. It looks at the cycles of overfishing in the North Atlantic that have been going on not just for decades, but for centuries. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. So, Jeffrey, as you said a minute ago, you went through tons and tons and hundreds of years worth of material. What's the big theme that emerges from all this documentation and data that you went through?
We're still having the same discussions that we were having 150 years ago. To some extent, the same discussions that were occurring here in the 17th century. I mean, one of the things that is quite remarkable that's come out of the book is that when the first English settlers arrived in New England, people that we think of typically as the Pilgrims or the Puritans, the magistrates, the leaders of those very embryonic societies, were determined not to overharvest in the ways that had been done at home.
So they made that mistake before.
Well, they came from England, or they came from this European coast, and they compared immediately this abundance lapping at their feet here in New England with what they knew at home. And so there were laws throughout the 17th century passed by the quote, Pilgrims and Puritans, Plymouth Colony, Massachusetts Bay Colony, to restrict overfishing, to restrict the abuse of the sea. Now, this went on for about a century until 1703, 1705 is about the last law to limit sea fishing. There were lots of laws to restrict river fishing, the anadromous fish like the sturgeon and the salmon and the shad that swim up the rivers conveniently to have their babies. Everyone knew that they could be whacked. But in the 17th century, the magistrates in New England were limiting fishing pressure on striped bass, on cod, on haddock, on mackerel, which seems to us, I mean, when there's 20,000 people settling in New England from Chittery to Connecticut, you're going to limit the fisheries. But there was something that kept them from trying to repeat what had gone on in the old world.
Right. So they'd seen it before. It does seem amazing, though, that way back then, people were saying, hey, we learned our lesson. We don't want to repeat the mistake here. So when does that start to shift, Jeffrey?
In New England, the laws to protect sea fish that had been on the books in the 17th century, that's the 1600s, had ended, as I said, by the very early 1700s. And there's not a return to the desire to protect sea fish, true sea fish, mackerel, cod, haddock, whatever, until the 1850s. So we have this 150-year window when there were no regulations or really serious discussions about it. Now, in the meantime, certain depletions were ongoing, and what prompted finally in the 1850s fishermen's insistence that their governments do something about depleted seas. And this is true in New England. It's true in Atlantic Canada. It's true in Norway. It's true in the United Kingdom, England and Scotland. All in the 1850s and 60s, sort of a perfect storm of awareness. And this is the first period in which the term overfishing begins to be used.
But in that long period before, what, 100, 150 years, it's almost a free-for-all.
Yeah, in many ways. There were, of course, restrictions on taking river fish. I mean, right here in New Hampshire, the Merrimack was once called the Sturgeon River. Of course, by the 1770s, sturgeon were very hard to be found, very rare in the Merrimack. But there were restrictions, again, on fishing at the falls for salmon, shad, alewives, and the rest.
Right, so they could reproduce.
Everyone knew that story. Everyone knew that fish that came in to reproduce in the rivers were vulnerable. You didn't need to have sophisticated gear. You didn't need to have a deep-sea ship. You just really need to have a simple net or a spear. But it's when attention shifts in the 1850s to the plight of true sea fish. And this is a chapter I called Making the Case for Caution. And so the first consistent case made by fishing communities to politicians to do something to perpetuate the resources on which their livelihoods depended, that's in the 1850s and 60s. So there's lots of evidence of depletion prior to that in whale populations, in seal populations, in sturgeon populations, in striped bass populations. I mean, Jeremy Belknap, the great New Hampshire historian for whom Belknap County is named, he wrote very poignantly in his book right after the American Revolution about the history of New Hampshire about the depletion of striped bass in the Piscataqua.
And right after the American Revolution. We're worrying about it as far back as that.
Yeah. Right. You know, as I write in the book, by the inauguration of George Washington, there had been already measurable impacts on coastal ecosystems in the Gulf of Maine. For instance, many of the great whales were no longer here. Well, they had been killed. Many of the anadromous fish, the salmon and the sturgeon, had seen their populations dramatically decreased. There had been impacts on the estuaries, which are very productive regions in the coastal ocean. They act as nursery habitat and feeding zones for many species of fish. So rather than the sea being immortal, rather than human control stopping at the shore, what we have here and what I think I've done in the book is demonstrate what was happening in late medieval Europe, what was happening in Renaissance Europe when fisher folk first came to the Americas, how they regarded this place as this extraordinary cornucopia. And then the impacts began here. So that by the late 1800s, we're sort of reversing the course of history, and American fishermen from Gloucester are heading towards Europe to make their trips. Hundreds of years before, Europeans had sailed this way, imagining that the fecundity, the productivity of these seas as inexhaustible. And yet by the 1870s, 80s, and 90s, American fishermen from Gloucester are sailing to South Africa for mackerel. They're sailing to Iceland for halibut.
That's a real wake-up call right there. We will talk a lot more after a short break and start taking your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. And more on the new book, The Mortal Sea, on the Exchange on NHPR. Then at 10 on the Diane Rehm Show, it's the Friday News Roundup. NHPR recently launched a new Arts and Culture Facebook page. Find out about arts events in your area, post events you're organizing, and, of course, join the ongoing discussion of New Hampshire's art scene. Check us out on Facebook at NHPR Arts. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from the Trust for Public Land, conserving parks, trails, and forests for people to enjoy since 1972. Information at tpl.org. For mother and child clothing and gifts in Nashua with expanded offerings that include recycled clothing for women and teens, plus fair trade and green products online at mothersays.com. And from the Gut Transition Project of the Center for Medical Home Improvement, helping teens move successfully from pediatric to adult health care. Information at guttransition.org. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, a new book on our centuries-long history of fishing in the North Atlantic and, as our guest says, of overfishing this region. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. If you have experience out on our seas, if you fish either commercially or for sport, what's your sense of how healthy fish stocks are these days? What sounds like a good balance to you of letting fish stocks recover and still allowing people to fish? Give us a call, the Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And Jeffrey Bolster, let's go to the phones. And Rick's calling from Conway. Hi, Rick. You're on the air. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much. It's a great topic. I do a little bit of studying in environmental science, and this is obviously one area that is of major concern if anybody's paying attention. But I wanted to ask your guest to comment on the exponentially difficult times we're in right now, and how modern technology in fishing has exponentially increased the depletion of the waters, and whether or not he's had an opportunity, and I'm sure he has, to see the documentary called End of the Line, which really looks at the tuna industry specifically.
Wow, Rick, you know, you have hit on it because a big theme, in fact, the theme in this book, Jeffrey, is the technology, the cycle. With every new fishing method, whether it's a bigger net or a better net or all the way up to the factory trawlers that we see now, people express fears that it'll be dangerous, it'll take too many fish. But then they kind of forget about it. More fish get pulled out, and things seem better for a time. And Rick, our caller, has really hit on just the major theme of this book.
Yeah, Rick, you're spot on. I haven't actually seen the End of the Line documentary. I've heard about it. I've read some reviews, so I'd like to see it. But in terms of speaking about the exponentially difficult times we're in because of technology, you're right. And going forward, it's easy to imagine that every 15-year-old kid in a Boston Whaler will have multi-beam side-scan sonar. And, you know, I can say that jokingly, but obviously when we look at the technology that's been available to everyone in the last 20 years, that is just going to continue to increase. So the sea's creatures in the future will have many fewer defenses than they even have today. As Laura said, really the theme of the book is that in every generation, fishers have recognized that the same number of men fishing the same gear in the same place at the same time were catching less. And they were concerned. And they insisted that their governments do something. And then a new technology would come along. And suddenly, oh, there's more fish. And so they would go back to fishing. And the two or three generations later, people say, oh, well, there's really fewer fish. Same old thing. And then a new technology. So I chart this very clearly throughout the book in terms of technology. Where we are today, of course, is that those technologies are not totally unleashed on the sea because of considerable regulations, which have been very disputed now for the last 20 plus years. But it is not too much to imagine that larger vessels, more powerful vessels, better fish finders, et cetera, will make the sea's creatures defenseless. I just delivered a boat to North Carolina last week from Kittery, Maine, and off the shore of New Jersey, about 60, 70 miles out, we came across one of the deep-sea shellfish boats. Well, they're 120-foot steel ships with this great vacuum apparatus to suck up clams from 60 miles offshore. Why are they out there clamming? Well, because the clam beds along shore that we could go dig with a clam rig have long since been exhausted.
Well, and it is surprising to see how far back this cycle of technology and worry about it, adaptation, and then fewer fish, and it just keeps going and going around, as you said. Give us an early example, Jeffrey, of a technology that really changed the way people pull fish from the sea that we today might not even call technology.
Right. Great question, Laura. The classic bottom fishing technology for centuries, from the Middle Ages up until the middle of the 1800s, was the hand line. And men first from Europe and then based here would sail out onto the fishing grounds on a boat, and they would lean over the rail and they would hand line. They had a line that had two hooks on it. They'd have two lines that would have two or four hooks maximum. So each man could tend two or four hooks. For centuries, there were several hundred thousand metric tons of cod being taken out of these North American ecosystems, shipped to Europe and elsewhere by handliners, okay? Just handliners. That's all they were doing. 1850s, 1860s, catches are going down. People are complaining, what are we going to do? They start to set out long lines. A long line is a long line that has shorter lines attached to it on which are hooks. Now a man could fish 400 hooks instead of four.
Wow, that's a big jump.
A big jump. But to set that, he would often leave his mothership in a small rowboat to go out into what people thought, this is lunacy, leaving the ship in the North Atlantic out in the fog and the gales. But they could have a larger hook footprint. Now today we would say, well, it's all hook fishing and it's hand fishing. There's no machines to haul back. The guys are hauling these long lines by hand. But simply by multiplying from four hooks to 400 and being able to set long lines in deeper water by having a sailing fishing vessel have a much larger hook footprint, catches went up dramatically.
Oh, I'm sure, okay. Exponentially.
And so, well, maybe not exponentially, but certainly dramatically. And so right there is one of the first shifts, a significant shift, which today we might look back and say, well, come on, it's all sailboats, it's all rowboats, it's hand line fishing, whether a guy is hauling back by hand a couple hundred hooks on a longer foot rope or just a hand, it's just sort of small scale stuff. But that's the point, that at each iteration of this new technology, it sort of erased what was known about previous depletions.
And in the 80s, I remember concern about factory trawlers. That's what they called them, especially coming from overseas. This is before we had more rules and regulations around who can fish in our waters and who can't. And people complained about these giant, giant ships from Russia and Japan and France. And they just basically yank, you know, untold quantities of fish out of the sea and freeze them and pack them right there in the boat. That was another huge leap in technology.
Yeah, that was the first of the big factory processors arrived here in 1954. And that era ended by the late 70s because by 1976 we had the 200-mile exclusive economic zone. But up until 76, you could, again, kids in the summer would go out from Nahant, Massachusetts in their Boston Whalers, and you could go out 3 miles, 3.1 miles offshore, which was then the legal boundary, and there were Soviet fishing ships out there at the height of the Cold War. And the joke is that Massachusetts boys could go out with their tennis balls and throw tennis balls off the sides of these big factory ships and catch them from their Boston Whalers. So we had 2,400-ton factory ships that could, in effect, scoop up all sorts of fish and process it right on board within 3 miles of the shore. When that ended, because of the 200-mile limit, the Magnuson Act, which was the imposition of American sovereignty over 200 miles out in the continental shelf, that would have been a time to get our house in order. That was a time when the Americans and the Canadians and other nations had driven away the foreigners. At this point now, it's just the domestic fisheries, in effect. That would have been a time to get the house in order. I had just finished college then. I was shipping out of Woods Hole, Massachusetts on research vessels. Acrimonious disputes in that little town, as well as in New Bedford and Fairhaven and the other fishing communities there, about what would happen going forward. And unfortunately, now we've watched the decades what has happened. It's been a very tawdry story.
And I want to get into something you just said there, Jeffrey, but let me also remind our listeners, you can join us too. Our number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Our guest is Jeffrey Bolster, an associate history professor at UNH. His new book is called The Mortal Sea, and it looks at the long, long history in our region of fishing, new technology leading to overfishing, and the cycle that continues and continues up until today. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. If you're out there on the seas fishing yourself, either commercially or for pleasure, what is your perception of how healthy the fish stocks are these days off the New England coast? How would you describe a good balance between letting fish stocks recover and still allowing folks to fish? The number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page or on the exchange page at nhpr.org. And Jeffrey, here's an email that came in from Michael in Hollis. He says, has the overfishing affected the size of fish genetically? Have we selected for smaller fish by harvesting the larger fish, or is it just that they don't have time to grow as big as they used to be? That's a great question, Michael. I remember being out at the Isles of Shoals a couple years ago, and I bumped into some archaeologists out there who were doing some work, and they said the things that they have dug up show them that cod used to be 7 feet long.
Yeah, that's a bit of an exaggeration, or else you didn't quite remember it right.
Wow.
But, you know, a record cod from the Gulf of Maine might have been close to 6 feet long. But the point is that it's a great question by email there, and it's one that is just being tackled through DNA analysis. And what's going on at this very moment at UNH is a new project to take cod bones from archaeological sites, including those of Seabrook, New Hampshire, including those at the Turner Farm, which is on North Haven, Maine, Penobscot Bay. Some of these bones go back thousands of years because they're in Indian middens. Some of them are, like on the Isles of Shoals, the remnants of a European commercial fishery from the early modern period, you know, the colonial period. So what we have at our disposal here is this range of cod remains that can be tested for DNA. Simultaneously, the goal is to do sample fishing on these remnant cod stocks here in the Gulf of Maine, whether in Ipswich Bay or even in the eastern Gulf of Maine, where the cod stocks are very depleted right now, and try to understand more about the structure of those stocks through time and also the extent to which there are separate stocks. Okay, so DNA analysis and isotopic analysis are new tools in the toolbox of scientists that may help us. I can't with certainty answer Michael's question right now, but I think it's one that will be answered in the near future. I will say that the way that I think that the book I've written contributes to this is that without a historical perspective, we have no idea of the restoration challenges we face. Without the historical perspective to get a sense of what the system was once like, we can't even ask the sorts of questions that Michael's just posed, but they are being asked and hopefully in the near future answered.
Well, and here's the question that comes out of me for this. So you've got the history, and you're saying you hope with that history to inform the present.
Mm-hmm.
There's this archaeological and scientific research going on the bones and the DNA and so forth. Once we have that picture, and your book contributes a lot to it, what do we do with it, Jeffrey? Do we just say, you know, nobody can fish ever, ever again? I mean, the world is hungry. People rely on fish. What do we do?
Yeah, you know, Laura, the idea that no one's ever going to fish again is just not going to happen. This is a democracy, just the United States. I'm not talking about the rest of the world right now, but these are political decisions, okay? And ultimately, many things that have been described in our lifetime as ecological disasters or environmental disasters are actually political disasters. Hurricane Katrina is one, for instance, you know? So the fisheries crisis today is one that is a result of political decisions, okay? And it's not that fishermen are the bad guys, or it's not that technology is the problem. It's fundamentally that we, the people, in our systems that have to do with democratic republicanism and capitalism and all the other systems that are interlocked, have never been very good at restraining ourselves, at policing ourselves. And going forward, it's very clear to me, very clear to anybody that's a thinking person, that the Earth's resources are not infinite. And so if we actually want to breathe oxygen and drink water and eat food and be protected from storms, we need to have some better sense of stewardship. That doesn't mean wearing a hair shirt and living in a tent, but people have to recognize that these resources are not infinite. So you take the knowledge and then you make policy. I'm not a policymaker, I'm a historian.
You just mentioned, you know, if we want to live on this earth and breathe and eat and survive, you talk real briefly, Jeffrey, in the book about the role that the oceans and their creatures play in our survival as a species, humankind. Even if you never eat fish, even if you live in the Midwest and right. You never go to the ocean, you know, even if you never touch a clam,
yeah,
the oceans matter and the creatures in it matter.
Yeah, and the simplest way to say that, Laura, is that it's not about the fish. Okay, so the Earth is 71% of the Earth is covered by the ocean. Much of the oxygen that we breathe is created by marine plants. The ocean is integral to the various processes. Imagine it as the Earth's heart and lungs, okay? It's the climate driver. It's the weather stabilizer. It produces oxygen. It's really important to how we live, whether you live in Kansas. So this isn't just about the fish. This is about something that's larger. And the sad truth is right now that with ocean acidification, with climate change, global warming, with overfishing, with the introduction of invasive species, with the reduction of marine habitats through pollution, we as a human species globally, different societies, have wreaked havoc on the ocean. So going forward, we, various human societies, should try to get our house in order and do a better job. It's not going to forgive us forever.
So even if the ocean's there, if it's empty of life, it doesn't have the plants and animals, it doesn't do the job that it's supposed
exactly.
to do.
And Laura, you know, the ocean will not be empty of life. It's just like life on Earth won't end if there's some really dark future. But, you know, you'll have bacteria. They'll thrive. Ants, yeah, probably cockroaches in the ocean. There'll be bacteria and jellyfish. But it's not what we as more sophisticated vertebrates want to see. So, my challenge is that this book I've written is a piece of a larger ecological conundrum, which societies face. Population right now about 7 billion, projected to go to 9 billion globally. How are we going to feed ourselves? And I think part of – maybe I could say it like this in terms of the high concept. American political and economic institutions were framed. They were imagined, conceptualized, and implemented, quote, constitutionally – in an era of ecological abundance. And we now live in an era of ecological scarcity. What are we going to do to get our institutions, political, economic institutions, in line with the new reality?
Let's take another call. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Susie's waiting in Peterborough. Hi, Susie. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Good morning. This is a history question for Jeff. It's about the dunfish that were made out in at the Isles of Shoals off our own little tiny coast. Back in the 1600s, dunfish, as I'm sure you know, was a special way of drying cod, salting and drying cod. And we're told by some historians that the fish were so abundant, and of course those were all caught by single lone fishermen in hand lining in their little shallops out there. But they were so abundant that they actually set the world price for dunfish from the tiny little Isles of Shoals back in the 1600s. Do you think that's actually the case?
I've heard that too, Susie, and that people all the world over ate dunfish from the Isles of Shoals. It's a great question. Thank you. Go ahead, Jeffrey.
Susie, thanks for the call. You clearly sound like you're an informed person using that term shallop, a little special terminology for boats. I can't tell you whether or not that particular line is true or whether it's myth. It's certainly a lovely way to put New Hampshire in the spotlight. But the point is that dunfish was actually made elsewhere besides just at the Isles of Shoals as well, too. The fish then in the 17th century were extraordinarily abundant. And in fact, I live in the south end of Portsmouth near Hunking Street, and I, in the introduction to the book, I mentioned Hercules Hunking, just a little signature thing. But he was one of the fishermen at the Isles of Shoals fishing from a shallop. The real point of that, though, is that in the early 1600s, the fish weren't just out at the Isles of Shoals. If you think about where the Bloody Point Bridge is from Newington towards Dover and Durham today, where the big new bridge is going in, that was the site there at where the Hilton brothers, fishmongers from Europe, settled in the 1620s. That's sort of the origins of Dover, New Hampshire. They were fishmongers catching cod. Were they going to the Isles of Shoals in their heavy shallops, 7 miles, 8 miles, 9 miles? No, no, no. They were taking merchantable quantities of cod out of the Piscataqua Estuary. Now, that's not something we think about. But that, Susie, might be the takeaway message from the 17th century, not that New Hampshire's dunfish were sort of captivating the world market. That's cool. But the fact that these cod existed in merchantable quantities way up the estuary all the way to Durham and Dover. That's food for thought.
Our number again is 1-800-892-6477. Susie, thanks for that one. More of your questions and comments after a short break.
This is NHPR, where support comes from you, our members, and Merrimack County Savings Bank, helping the community thrive for 144 years with 7 full-service branches in Bogue, Kentucky, Concord, and Nashua, themerrimack.com. And from the Hannah Grimes Business Incubator in Keene, helping entrepreneurs succeed with combined office space, learning, and networking opportunities, hannahgrimes.com. Good morning. It's 9:40. This is NHPR.
NHPR has logged a lot of miles this year, from the Northern Pass Project to the hepatitis outbreak at Exeter Hospital to tracking candidates ahead of New Hampshire's many elections. Your old car has logged a lot of miles, too, as you've listened into our signature reporting. So, as the tax year winds down, consider taking advantage of our vehicle donation program. We'll take care of all the paperwork, pick up your car, and auction it off. All you need to do is call 1-877-393-NHPR or visit NHPR.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Be sure to join The Exchange for a special sit-down with New Hampshire Governor John Lynch as he prepares to leave the corner office. We'll talk with Governor Lynch on Tuesday about the challenges he's faced, the victories he's seen, and some of his advice for incoming Governor-elect Maggie Hassan. You can email us your questions that you'd like me to ask the governor at exchange@nhpr.org in advance of the program. Again, exchange@nhpr.org if you want me to get your question in for Governor Lynch. Today in The Exchange, UNH Professor Jeffrey Bolster is with us on his new book, The Mortal Sea, which explores our centuries-long history of fishing and, he says, especially overfishing the North Atlantic. Our number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Here's an email that came in from Sheila, Jeffrey. It says, I've lived in Hampton, New Hampshire since 1969, used to handline in Hampton Harbor. Dinner was often haddock or flounder. That no longer happens. I married a fisherman who gill-netted and dragged. When asked by our government to stop so that the stocks could restore themselves, he did. There was a promise he would be allowed to return. He took up lobstering. Those who stayed in the fishing industry fished heavily enough to deplete the inshore stocks. He was never able to get enough days to return to ground fishing and has made a living lobstering. Unlike their colleagues, the lobstermen have preserved and protected their stocks and even with the crash in prices can continue to make a living. Again, this is Sheila. And Sheila, boy, thanks a lot. Lots in that email. Couple things I want to ask you from it. First of all, lobstering. That's an interesting tale from the book.
Thanks, Sheila, for the email. I suspect I know who you are. the lobstering story is a compelling one. Your husband is fishing right now, is lobstering and making a living at it right now. There are a lot of lobsters in the Gulf of Maine. In fact, as we know, last summer, the price for fishermen was getting low. The supply and demand was working against fishermen because they were landing so much they couldn't sell it.
Yeah, lobster was cheaper than beef.
Right. People were saying lobster was cheaper than bologna. But here's if we frame the story through more than a century, what we have is in the middle of the 19th century, a totally unregulated lobstering that took off with canning. And until you could put lobster meat in cans, there was no real market for it because you could only land live lobsters and you couldn't transport them very far. By the 1840s and 50s, canning comes in. Maine lobsters, then later Nova Scotian lobsters, are hit. So that 1888 is the peak year. By the 1890s, the lobster landings have crashed to only 50% of what they'd been in the 1880s. And everybody said the good days were back in the 70s. It took 60 years for lobster landings to come back up, just to reach that level of 1888. It wasn't until the 1950s that landings even reached what they'd been in 1888. Now, by the 1950s, you had bigger boats, you had motor boats. Guys weren't just fishing out of rowboats anymore. But now, in our lifetimes, recently, we've seen landings go from 20 million pounds a year to 30 million pounds to 60, 100 million pounds in Maine. What's happened? Well, the ecosystem is not static. The ecosystem is always in the midst of fluctuations, okay? Right now, we know that the Gulf of Maine waters are getting warmer. We believe that has contributed significantly to the recruitment or retention of juvenile lobsters that turn into bigger lobsters. In the meantime, there are fewer predators in the Gulf of Maine. The ground fish that once cruised the bottom munching on some small lobsters are gone. That may be contributing as well. But right now, what we have is the lobster fishery in the Gulf of Maine is the most important one. And a lot of men who had been in the ground fish business, like Sheila's husband, don't have access to that anymore. They're lucky that they have access to lobstering. That's great. But if the lobster stocks crash, which they have in the past, then we're really facing a crisis.
Sheila, thanks a lot for that email. Good to hear from you, especially since your family's been involved in this issue. And let's take a call, if we could, Jeffrey. Eric is in Portsmouth. Eric, go ahead. You're on The Exchange, and thanks for calling in.
Yes, good morning, Laura. Yep, I'm out fishing right now, so I knew the show was coming and listening to it. And so we're on the water. I think the show's been informative. Some of the issues that you addressed earlier was with technology and some of the fishing technology that's developed, and no doubt it has. But I think the focus, there's been a focus on taking technology in a better light for the industry, for the resource, and being more selective gear, and not focused as much on harvesting as it is on, you know, fishing for the abundant species, and leaving some of the other, you know, depleted species, you know, alone. And then there's also the issue of the current management regime. You're right. The management regime is politically motivated, and it's caused a lot of controversy, especially where it's headed right now. And I think that has to be addressed at some particular time. We've gone into a different management regime through the Magnuson Act. We don't know if that's the correct direction, but we've got the better part of 30 years of trying, you know, of aggressive management roles, and we don't know whether they're working.
And Eric, you're saying fishermen are able now to be more selective. Okay, so this particular fish is in trouble, so we can now not drag that fish up in our nets or get that fish. We can just get the ones that we know are healthy and are okay. Is that what you're saying, Eric?
Yeah, it gets to be very technical, but the gear is being developed to catch, you know, target species versus just, you know, everything that the deer encounters.
Sweeping everything up, yeah. Eric, I want to let Jeffrey jump in here. Really good to hear from you since you're out fishing right now. That's great. This is a really important point because you do write that some of the newer technology just dragged everything up with it, including young fish, including, you know, things that no one would even eat but that are important to the Earth's ecosystem. I mean, I think that he's making a really fundamental point here.
Yeah, Eric's a very knowledgeable guy. I've read his column a number of times in the paper. We've been on some panels together, if it's the Eric, I think it is. And he's spot on with a lot of these issues. Obviously, we as a society, we could put men on the moon, and yet at the time that we put men on the moon, we're still fishing with really crude gear that was very destructive, not just taking targeted species. So Eric is absolutely right, which is that improvements in gear so that you can take a targeted species, let's say Gulf of Maine shrimp in season, without bycatch or the unintentional killing of other species, very important. Eric raises the point about the management regime. Of course, it's politics. Yes, everything's politics. He says he doesn't know whether it's working. That's probably my single bone of contention with what he said, and I would just pitch it like this. My sense is that we have to – without management, it's over, okay? There has to be some restrictions on what we catch. Now, the specifics of the management regime, specifically since it's been changed since 2010, are clearly up for discussion. A lot of fishermen are unhappy with that. But in the larger – the larger scope about whether we should have management or not, I quite honestly feel that since the 1980s, the mantra about getting the government off our backs, deregulating. If you're talking about exploitation of marine resources and you use that language, it's just a showstopper because there won't be a future. So I think we need to go ahead as a society, do exactly what Eric is talking about with better gear, trying to fish for some species that are somewhat more abundant right now, leaving the depleted ones alone, and of course continue the discussion about what is the best management regime. There are always winners and losers in political decisions, including different groups of fishermen, depending on what gear, what species they're fishing. But winners and losers can also be the larger society as a whole. They can also be parts of that ecosystem. And we need to ask ourselves some serious questions about whether all of the fisheries that we're engaged in as a society are still appropriate and what we're going to do going forward.
Can we still, given the depletion that you see, fish in what's called a sustainable way? You mentioned earlier, Jeffrey, you know, 7 billion people on the planet, projected to go to 9 billion. A lot of those people are going to need to eat fish.
Yeah, you know, some people, Laura, would say that the term sustainable fisheries is oxymoronic or that you can't do it. I wouldn't go quite that far. But certainly what sustainable fisheries really means is fishing so that the spawning stock biomass of the fish continues to grow, so that the species continues to grow, so that we get a greater distribution of age classes. I mean, for instance, right now, most of the lobster that's being landed are all exactly the pound and a quarter lobsters that fit on a plate. The lobster population does not have the sort of age distribution and size distribution that it once had in a more natural state. This is true, of course, of codfish. An earlier caller who asked about DNA raise that point. What we know about cod is that the size of average cod in the Gulf now is smaller than it was, cod that's landed, and also that we're missing many of the really large fish. It turns out that large fish reproduce much more effectively than small fish. So again, having that sort of age distribution is more effective. So when we talk about sustainable fisheries going forward, we need to ask these questions. We also need to ask questions about working waterfronts and having not just fish for the future, but fishermen for the future. I was a commercial mariner for 10 years. I've always hung with guys that went to sea. And I very much, sort of as a political being, want there to be working waterfronts in the future. I think we want to have a future that has both fish and fishermen. And yet much of the discussion, as it still goes on, and this is what I think is the tragedy and the irony of this book I've written, much of the discussion that still goes on is couched in many of the same terms that have gone on for a very long time. It can't just be pitted as fishermen against regulators. There has to be some more coming together. Sounds a little naive, but if the U.S. Congress can do it, maybe the fisheries industry can do it too.
Let's take one more call if we could. This is Jorge in Durham. Hi, Jorge. Thanks for hanging on. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi, Lori. First, I want to thank you for the program. I listen to you every day when I come to UNH to work. As a historian, as a humanist that has read most of the chronicles of the explorers of America, I think I had problems with the approach that the guest had at the beginning of the program. I agree with the idea that we have to exhaust, that we have to control the and restrict the fishing in America and all around the world because we are exhausting our resources. But the problem comes when we use historical sources in order to justify our ideas. Because I heard the guest at the beginning of the program saying that that when they were talking about the abundance of fishes, it was not just a political attempt, but it was something that the mariners did because they were observers. Well, I have to disagree with that, first of all, because it was a political attempt, not just to come to America, but also as an excuse for the mariners, who most of them failed in their attempt to achieve their goals, so they had to write a kind of a diary for the next people who were coming to America in order to see, well, at least I achieved this.
And I see also, what you're saying.
Yeah.
Jorge, I'm going to let you go ahead real quick, and then we'll ask Jeff what he thinks.
And also, I disagree in the way that we cannot say that they are accurate. First of all, because if they are accurate, we have to take the whole chronicle as accurate. And in the chronicles, not only they talk about a lot of fishes, but also about the presence of Amazons, monsters, the presence of Garden of Eden in America. And so far as I know, we haven't found the Garden of Eden in America.
Jorge, thank you so much. I got to let you go. But, you know, here he's saying, look, you find a lot of other stuff in these early accounts that everybody would kind of roll their eyes and go, okay, whatever they were embellishing. So he's kind of questioning those early accounts that you referenced at the beginning of the show, Jeffrey.
Yeah, and, you know, I would respectfully disagree. I think Jorge is very wide of the mark here. And it simply goes like this. Of course, there are references to things that we now don't imagine as existing to see. In fact, I talk in this book about sea serpents. And I talk about sea serpents in the book because some of the best and brightest minds at the time imagined that there were sea serpents.
Off the coast of Massachusetts.
Yeah.
Yes, you write a lot about
among
that.
Others. And so the point there, Jorge, is to not use historical sources and to not contextualize them, to not use them for what they can best reveal to us, is extraordinarily short-sighted. What you're suggesting is that the best and brightest minds of the past were not nearly as good as we are, that here we are, the best and brightest minds of today, and we've got all the answers. I so fundamentally disagree with that. Of course, I am a historian. I spend my professional life working in the past to the extent it's possible. I don't accept everything from the past uncritically. One thing historians do is try to figure out who was lying in the past, okay? But to throw out the baby with the bath, to suggest that nothing that comes out of these chronicles from the past is useful now, extraordinarily short-sighted, and I just fundamentally disagree with that.
Well, Jorge, thank you for calling in. And I want to finish with a quick email. This is from Jenny in Northampton. She says, quick question regarding fishing. Could you ask Jeff where he stands on fish farming? Good or bad, Jenny says. Thanks, Jenny. And, you know, that's something that I wanted to ask you, too, given that, you know, billions of people, many of whom want to, need to, consume fish.
It's a great question, and, you know, for several decades now, aquaculture or fish farming has been promoted as one of the potential solutions to the exhaustion of sea fish. And certainly many of the fish that are consumed today, some European bass, salmon, for instance, are farmed, not to mention others. UNH has been pioneering in terms of this, trying to develop the technology to make farming flounder or cod be competitive in terms of the market. It hasn't quite happened yet. They've solved the technological problems over a decade, but not yet brought down the price point sufficiently low. Here's the short and long of the aquaculture issue. Aquaculture pens are often anchored in estuaries, and then you end up with problems of the fish defecating and the food building up and antibiotics in the feed going to the estuary. You also have problems with wild stocks such as salmon commingling with these raised stocks if the pens are broached by porpoises or sharks or just break. So the aquaculture is not considered today to be as much of the silver bullet solution as it once was, although it is certainly one solution going forward. And I think the kind of open ocean aquaculture pens that the UNH engineers were working on is one way to move that forward because it takes fish farming out of estuaries, which are vulnerable environments. That said, the catch-22 is that most of the fish that are farmed in these pens are fed other fish that are taken, bait fish, you know, capelin or sand lance or some other smaller fish that are caught and turned into kibble, looks like dog chow, which is then fed to the salmon or the fish in the pens. So you don't get something for nothing. And as we all know, the farther one goes up the food chain, the less usable protein for the end consumer, in this case humans, you get. So would we be better feeding lower down on the food chain, which some are called forage fish, as opposed to catching those fish, turning them into dog food pellets, and chucking those back into salmon in pens? Big discussion. Great question.
Well, thank you so much, Jenny, for that email. And boy, there's been so much to talk about, Jeffrey Bolster. Thanks a lot for coming in today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Laura. Been nice talking with you.
Jeffrey Bolster, an associate history professor at UNH. His focus is on the history of people's interactions with the sea. His new book is called The Mortal Sea, Fishing the Atlantic in the Age of Sail. Don't forget to join us Tuesday on The Exchange for a special sit-down with New Hampshire Governor John Lynch as he prepares to leave the corner office. Email us your questions that you'd like me to ask Governor Lynch to exchange@nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and be sure to join us Tuesday, December 3rd, for a one-hour interview with New Hampshire Governor John Lynch as he prepares to step down. We'll look back with him at his 8 years in New Hampshire's corner office, his victories, his challenges, and what advice he'd impart to Governor-elect Maggie Hassan. Our broadcast is in collaboration with New Hampshire Public Television. Email us questions that you'd like me to ask the governor to exchange@nhpr.org. That's Tuesday, December 3rd, live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. here on NHPR.
The Diane Rehm Show and the Friday News Roundup next at 10 on